How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back, everybody. Another packed show. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking again to Charlotte Wood. And Charlotte was on a couple years ago, almost 2 years ago, with Stoneyard Devotional. She's our favorite alum, award-winning, best-selling Australian author. And they have smartly re-released her book, The Natural Way of Things, which came out about 10 years ago. An amazing, scary, inspiring book. We'll have her on. But first, Lauren is doing the important work this evening for Claude. Thank you, Lauren. David and I have just completely dissected yesterday's wonderful UConn win over Duke. And our dear friend and literary icon, James Grady. Mr. Grady, welcome back.
I'm so happy to be here and to be part of hearing the two of you. The two of you made basketball in the Final Four come alive. So Lauren and I are...
Jim, twice in the last several weeks, David has talked me off the ledge. I'm texting him from a game at which Duke is present.
Who were you watching when you almost got in a fight? What was that one?
That was Duke versus Michigan.
Oh, right. That's right.
Yeah, Duke versus Michigan. Oh, okay. Last one, I swear to God. So yesterday, after Michigan's win, and they're in the Final Four, Godspeed, I wear to the game my Michigan, my bright yellow Michigan hoodie. And it's pretty warm, so I could march right into Cap One. We're walking, getting into our seats, and I swear to God, a Duke fan goes, what the bleep are you wearing that for? So David saves me. Okay, we've done the Final Four. Jim, we were just talking. You're going to be back on as our featured author in about 6 weeks with a new book. Give us a teaser.
I wanted to write a book that helped explain how we got to where we are today. And there's this great Bob Dylan quote where he, and I might have the order a little wrong, where he said, quote, sex and murder and politics are the way to go if you want to get people's attention.
That's a great rule of life.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I mean, who am I to argue with a Nobel Prize winning for literature author? So I wrote a erotic noir novel that deals with racism, that deals with sexism, that deals with a little bit with the political corruption, but also small town America and how we all got to where we are today. And I hope that I'm able to get some of the subtle points across while people are turning pages from one suspenseful murder scene to the next suspenseful erotic scene.
And nice.
Let's hope it works.
What's the takeaway going to be? I've done the pre-order. When I get it and I read it, what's the takeaway?
That we all get offered a chance to do something that could either destroy us or move us forward to a better time.
Nice. No pressure there.
Yeah, no. And that we're all essentially, like the title says, shadows on sidewalks.
Yeah.
You know, we're here, and what our shape is in our time depends on how we walk, which way we turn, how we move, and the sidewalk we're standing on.
Nice. Nice. Get to sum those up. Okay. Also, an excellent segue. Every once in a while, we have one. Just so people know, I've shared this with some people on the show, but usually on Thursday, sometimes Wednesday, for the people who are on the show on Monday, I send out a little email with the notes of who's on and links to this and that, whatever, and a loose rundown of the show. Two-thirds of the time, it gets completely blown out of the water, but that's okay. But I keep threatening to talk about AI and its impact on the literary world.
Oh, my God.
Jim is shaking his head for those of you watching on News Channel 8.
Yeah.
It's a big daggone deal. And I sent these guys a link to a story, I think it was in the New York Times, about there's this book. It was called Shy Girl. People are raving about it. It's getting great reviews. And then, you know, alert readers go, wait a minute. It's a lot of the language in that book sounds like it was created by one of these models, AI models. And sure enough, now the author is blaming it on an editor.
Right.
Saying that the editor, so who knows about all that. But the impact Okay, Jim, you first, and then David, you. Impact of AI on writing, just in the broadest sense, good, bad, in between.
I think it's terrible. I think it's dangerous. And I think, yes, it will impact all us authors, but what is more and perhaps most dangerous, I think, is that the AI will not reach the human condition and will not write about the true human condition in a way that helps people live their daily lives. And that's the artificial intelligence is, I think, one of the greatest dangers that we are facing now. And it doesn't have to be. I mean, you go back to an author like Isaac Asimov, who created the three laws of robotics, in which one of the first laws is first AI or robots must do no harm to human beings. I don't see anywhere in legislation or corporate maneuvering where the idea that we should protect you and I and all of our viewers and listeners out there from this massive machine is being talked about and worked on. I mean, was it, I think, 8 days ago that a robot walked out of the White House behind our First Lady and had arms and legs and waved to the crowd.
But in a fashion sense, Jim, matched completely with Melania, who's a black and white. She wears a lot of black and white. The robot was black and white.
Oh,
That
well, of course.
was a nice touch. It's a nice touch. Okay, if we have time, I'll push back on you slightly about the human condition. But David,
Yes.
real world impacts on journalism. What do you
I
think?
literally just sent you that half hour ago about the review of a book by the New York Times that somebody realized, boy, this sounds familiar, and they checked it out. And of course, the reviewer had used AI and had basically plagiarized off of a Guardian book review of the same. And is the New York Times, for goodness sake?
At least they admitted
The
to it.
hubris of somebody saying, I'm just going to put this in the New York Times and nobody's going to check it. Like, what?
Yeah.
It's
I recently,
unbelievable.
last Wednesday, had dinner with a very good friend of mine, Janelle, and her son, Jake, who's a freshman at Georgetown. And we started talking about this. And I said, how much do you use it to him? I said, how much do you use it in your daily life, in your classes, and these kinds of things? And he was just laughing at the stupidity of people like us and of a certain age that
Yeah.
think that these things can't be detected. There are 95 apps that professors can and do run against everything that is submitted to them that immediately recognizes something as
Yeah.
AI generated. So one would think, when you and I have talked before, the New York Times has adapted to the digital world in a pretty good way. In
Yeah.
many, many ways, you
Yeah.
would think they would have figured this out by now.
Yeah. And it just, I mean, look, James is in a much higher level of writing than I am. But I know as a writer, what is the point of doing this if it's not your idea? I don't
Exactly.
understand. What's the
Thank
point?
you.
Why are we doing it?
Exactly.
I don't get it.
You know?
This is everything that I write is what I'm thinking, and it's how I think,
Yeah.
how I see the world. And if you farmed it out to somebody, some not human thing, what are we
Right.
doing? I don't
But David,
understand.
there's a connection to something we have talked about on this show when we do chatter on sports, which is it's like the crazy people happens all the time. They're running a marathon, they've trained for the marathon, but they cheat.
Yeah.
What's the point? Or people, there are all these apps you can sign up to track your running times and this and that, right? And
Yeah.
people have figured out how to game the app. What is the
Oh.
effing point?
Yeah.
But it's the same thing with this. They just want to get it out there, I guess.
But we just lose every with every day we lose more of our humanity.
Yeah.
It's
Oh, okay. Here's
it's
the
just.
humanity, human condition thing, though. So, a lot of people, a lot of young people should reach out and get therapy, use therapy. Good therapy can be wonderful therapy, right? A lot of people do not reach out and get the therapy they need. I'm very familiar with the military veteran community. They do not like to reach, in general, don't like to reach out for therapy. Think of young people. Young people do also do not like to, but an extraordinary percentage of young people are willing to start having a conversation with a bot, essentially, online. And they'll have, okay, Jim's role, for those of you watching New Channel 8, Jim's right. But here's the thing, Jim. They're willing to reach out and have this conversation. They are fully aware it's not a human being. And that's the reason they're willing to share the information. That's the reason they're willing to say what's worrying them and get some response. There are problems. We all know there are the horrible, horrible situations where some poor kid isn't waved off and he commits suicide. But a really large number of young people, just to stay in that community for now, are getting at least the start of conversation that they need. So I think that's a human condition kind of thing, which is good.
I never thought of that. And in a way, it's a little bit like a person who's afraid to go to therapy or can't afford to go to therapy. Instead of picking up a what we used to call self-help book, maybe now what they're getting from AI is what they get in a much more personalized fashion than what they would have gotten from, the self-help book published 5 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's like anything else. You need rules of the road. To your point about policymakers, it's not that they're not focused on it, Jim. It's that policy, especially when it comes to technology, is always 10, 15, 20 years behind. They can't move quickly enough. They can't catch up. They can't, they try. It's interesting, the legal battle recently that Meta and Instagram lost, that was a very, very big deal. The courts tend to move more quickly in these areas, but don't hold your breath waiting for the policymakers because that's just too slow. Just too slow. Okay. All right. There we go. David, where do you put that game in the icon of in the list of games?
Right up there. It's right up there. It's one of the best games I've ever seen. It was phenomenal. Two great teams, two great programs with great traditions.
I love people comparing it. Was Christian Laettner shot in 94?
That was 92, I believe.
92. This was
Yeah.
a better shot than Christian Laettner
It was
shot
a
in
deeper
92.
shot. I mean, Christian Laettner's shot was
Right.
a great shot, but it was a free throw line jumper, which is
Yeah.
fairly easy to make. This was a 35 footer, which is very difficult to make. It's
Yeah.
extremely difficult to make.
By the way, shocking to everybody, but you'll be interested to know at Cap One Arena, where I spend a lot of time to watch the Caps, where I will be tomorrow evening. It's a slightly different crowd watching an
But
Elite Eight basketball game than a hockey game.
oh,
Just
yeah, emphasis on elite.
emphasis on elite, emphasis on, I'm really happy. I'm not an untall person. Seeing a lot of people who are much taller than I am. Hilarious to see the people wearing Duke basketball shirts. You're like, no, you never. Some women who were dressed to kill with the custom, the Boozer women. That's Boozer is the two, the twin, not tw
The
are they
twins,
twins, David? Yeah, twins. Twins on Duke's team wearing custom coats and things like that. That was very
yeah,
cool.
that's what they do. That's what they do. But I'm just more. I want to. This AI thing just bugs me because
Go.
it just scares me because now you can't even trust any video you see. You can't trust. You
Oh.
just they're all fakes, all of them. And so now you don't trust anything, which I think is kind of the point of this, which is to sow doubt about everything you see, that everything you see isn't real. And if you think nothing is real, then you can be manipulated to think anything is real.
Yeah, I think it's the last Harper's or the Harper's before this issue. And they do this list of, facts or whatever they call it. And according to data, one of their lines, 90% of what's posted on Facebook and Instagram is fake.
Wow.
And
Wow.
I have a hard
Wow.
time believing that, even though it's Harper's that
Yeah.
I've trusted for hell all my life, essentially. But about the only social media I use is Facebook, and when I keep getting these, like you say, really original and really credible looking videos of everything, pictures of everything, but they can't be real. I mean, Bruce Springsteen in a wheelchair and with a news story.
Yeah.
And just on and on. It's scary.
Okay. Two things that I really hope are true, because I've been following them religiously on TikTok.
Mm-hmm.
Punch the Monkey.
I'm
are you
not
guys
familiar
familiar with Punch the
with
Monkey?
Mr. or Ms. Monkey.
Oh my gosh. Really? Of four people, I'm the only one who knows Punch the Monkey? Lauren, you're disappointing me.
Sorry.
Okay, this is true. So Japanese zoo, it's the monkey pavilion or whatever, you know, multiples of monkeys. And there's a little young monkey named Punch, and his mother rejects him, says, no Punch for me. And he gets abandoned, and all the other monkeys start beating up on Punch. And the zookeepers felt so badly for Punch. This is true. The zookeepers felt so badly for Punch that they went to IKEA and they bought him a stuffed toy orangutan.
Okay.
And so for a week or two, poor little Punch is dragging his orangutan with him and, you know, hugging it. And this is his friend, causing millions of people to go to IKEA to buy the stuffed orangutan for $15. Oh, it's selling out, right? You get your Swedish meatballs and your orangutan. So then the story progresses. Swear to God, people are getting on planes to go to the zoo to see Punch and his stuffed orangutan. Then, this is a little, one of the older males in the group decides he's going to befriend Punch.
Is his name Reginald?
An older male befriends Punch for a little bit, and we're a little bit worried about that. But now Punch has a girlfriend.
There you go. See, Punch is the sensitive one. You could. We all saw it coming. You know where this is
okay,
going.
Do you know about the dogs in China?
No.
I hope this is true, because this is only about a week old. So a truck is going down the road in China. It's filled with dogs that are on their way to the meat market because they eat dogs in China.
Right.
Pregnant pause. Seven dogs escape. Little hodgepodge dogs escape from the truck saying, not for us. They start hightailing it down the road back from which they came. And it's a little hodgepodge dogs, including a German shepherd that is injured, a corgi, we used to have a corgi, who is leading the pack. And they go something like 10 or 15 miles down the highways, over rivers and streams, and find their way back to wherever they came from.
Okay.
It should be a movie.
This sounds like something. This sounds like a 1963 movie with the Rat Pack. You know,
doesn't
with
it?
Dean Martin's in it.
Yeah.
Peter Lawford.
Dean Martin being the dog that croons.
Exactly. Okay. Sinatra has a cameo. I love this. Let's make this.
It should be a Disney movie for sure. Okay. So
are you going to the Final Four tour?
Here's the only reason to go to the final. I will go to the Final Four.
You should go. It's in Indy. It's easy. It's an easy one.
It is. It's easy. And our son Charlie, just so you know, I think Lauren knows this.
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
Our son Charlie went to Michigan. Right. Love Charlie. Love it. So about 2 months ago, Charlie starts reaching out to Brian, my husband, and me, saying, "Hey, who wants to go to a World Cup game?" I'm like, if you want to make a big deal about going to the Women's World Cup, okay, but just not that interested, right? Well, he keeps it up. And then about 10 days ago, he reaches out again, but now he's just going just to my husband. He goes, "Seattle World Cup, have tickets, let's go." Brian says, "I'm going." By the way, Brian is going to opt out of a kind of important social obligation that we were supposed to both be attending.
To
go to this. It's okay. It's okay. And so now I'm thinking, David, because there's nothing like revenge in our relationship.
Absolutely.
Go to the Final Four with Charlie for Michigan.
I think that is absolutely what you should do.
Thank you.
He has to he's going to have to eat this one. Yeah, of course.
I think so, too. And at this, we're so close to the game. You got to go. You have no choice.
Can you get good tickets? Now, it's at Lucas Oil Stadium, which is a football stadium.
It's just a price, my friend.
I know, but I'm saying if you're going, you don't want to be sitting in like row 700. You want good seats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which we would get.
All right.
The last time, Lauren and Jim, this is like chatter on marital relationships. The last time, text from Charlotte. Oh my God, so sorry. 1 minute. Here she comes. Okay, we have time.
Here she comes. You're going to tell them the master story?
Yeah. So many years ago, this is a long time ago. David and I first met via Tony Kornheiser doing Tony's show, radio and then podcast. Great. We used to laugh and say we would pay him to be on that show, which we would not now. Anyways, so I'm sitting there getting ready to tape Tony's show, and I get a text from my husband. He goes, "Oh my God, so-and-so just called, wants to know about the Masters." Nah, nah, nah. He's like, and he didn't say we. But he somehow implied this kind of general thought of going to the Masters. And I am not a golfer, but it's an iconic event. I've always wanted to go. My husband knows this. And I said, I'm texting, going, great, when do we leave? And my husband, Brian, goes, there's no we. No. So not only was I not invited, not only did he ask if I could go, he decides he's going to go. And by the way, our three children completely got on my side on this one. So he goes off for 3 days at this iconic event and really didn't have to spend much at all. But he went, what's the store called, David? Bergman's?
Oh, I can't remember. I don't know. I've never been, but I know the store you're talking about.
So the thing about the Masters is if you go, you buy these little egg salad sandwiches and they cost a dollar. And it's all very quaint and wonderful. But you go to Bergman's, the store with all the merch, and you pay $500 for a really ugly polo shirt. So Brian knows he's at the Masters for 3 or 4 days. He's in the doghouse with me, big time, our three children, big time. He comes back with what, I'm not kidding, was $5,000 worth of merch. Ugly merch, by the way. Meanwhile, I'm hanging out with my horse friends, and there's my friend Ed Lane. He's got this cute horse, but he needs to do something else to do with it. And I said, I'll buy the horse. Hi, Charlotte. I said, I'm buying the horse. It's kind of like that MasterCard commercial. Brian spent $5,000 buying merch, trying to make up for us not being at the Masters with him. And the horse was a lifetime commitment. It was great. And just to rub it in, I named the horse Grady, which was his mother's maiden name.
Oh,
so
I get
every day and every month when he saw the bills for Grady, he'd have to go, that was a big mistake. Big.
You should have named it after a golfer. You should have named it Ballesteros or something. That would have been funny.
Charlotte Wood, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, I apologize for my lateness. I'm so sorry.
No worries, no worries, no worries. We think it's late morning your time, Australia?
Yes, it's 9:30.
There you go. Okay, we're evening. But thank you so much for joining us and being back with us. Intros, David, I don't know how they show up on your screen, but David, you've met before. James Grady is our literary icon who shockingly spends time with us here on Chatter on Books. And Lauren Larson is the person who does all the important work and puts this show together. So,
hi, Laura.
There are intros. Okay, so Charlotte, a lot of things have happened since the last time you were on the show. Specifically, Stoneyard Devotional blew up.
It did. It was a great surprise to many of us, especially me, I think.
What was the experience like?
Oh, it was amazing. It sort of quietly came out in Australia and then in the UK, and then it got on the Booker Prize long list and then the short list, and then it did kind of go off around the world, and then it was released in the States and had, you know, amazing reviews and support, and it's been a dream, really.
New York Times said one of their top 10 books of 2025.
Oh, yes. That was completely out of the blue and very exciting.
Yeah, we took credit for it.
Excellent. Well, so you should.
Yeah, exactly. Was it all good atmospherics, or did it put some pressure on you that was less than ideal?
No, look, it was good. I've been doing this long enough to know, you know, when to be grateful and gracious. And I really have been. And actually, you know, I'm just about to finish a new novel. So I've been kind of working away in between things. And it's great. I think that pressure thing, you know, Stoneyard Devotional was my 10th book. Mm-hmm. I think if that sort of thing happened on your first book, it could really destabilize you, or you would expect this is what it's like. You know? And anyone who's been writing for a long time knows you can never predict those things. So you just do your work and, put it out in the world and see what happens.
That's great.
Can you tell?
And the world decided they wanted to see the natural way of things again.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
That was a big surprise. And, you know, so I published that book 10 years ago in the States and 11 years ago in Australia. And you sort of think, oh, that time has passed, you know, but horribly relevant still, as it turns out. And I think the week it was republished in the States with that incredibly beautiful new cover design, it was just a couple of weeks before that, the latest Epstein files were released, which showed me that this stuff has not gone away. And it's eerily current, is the phrase,
which I'm sure I've stolen from someone else, because we were talking about AI earlier. So now, and now I can't help myself, Dave. Anything I say now, I go, gosh, from whom did I steal that?
I am from Washington.
The New York Times, when this was re-released, they did something where they don't often, I looked this up and I asked some people, Charlotte, and they said, no, we don't, you know, re-releases, we don't tend to review those, but they did review The Natural Way of Things. And here's what it said. The ongoing joke about dystopian fiction, though it seems to get less funny all the time, is that reality rarely lags far behind. Today's speculative hell, give it a day, a month, a year, and it's a documentary. So give us the 10 seconds. Jamie McIntyre here would say, okay, tell us what it's about. But give us the 10 seconds on the plot of the book, and then we'll dig in.
So the book opens with two young women waking up out of a sort of drugged state in a place they've never been. They understand that they have been brought here from their homes in the city. It's a abandoned, what we would call a sheep station, a ranch in the middle of Australia. They don't know where they are. And they're held captive there by two quite horrible guards, male guards, who are both incompetent and nasty. And that's a really bad combination. And they realize there are other girls here. They call themselves girls. They're all young women. And they come to realize that what unites them is that they've all been involved in some kind of scandal, in scare quotes, some kind of sexual misdemeanor has taken place at the hands of a powerful man or men. And those men have a company that they can call on called Harding's International that goes around and picks up these troublesome women and dumps them in this prison in the middle of nowhere. And so then the question for the book is, you know, how are they to escape? Is someone going to rescue them? Do they have to rescue themselves?
It was eerily current. It just keeps coming back to me. That phrase just keeps coming back to me. And I don't want to make too many connections with the Epstein files, but I was reading something
weird.
About the Epstein.
It's weird. It's weird.
Well, a lot of the Epstein women that he had at these various, you know, salons that he had were named Dasha. And I wonder, and some remarkable, so many of them were named Dasha. They all seem to be Eastern European, Russian. That at some point, one of Epstein's assistants had to ask him when he was talking about a dinner he was putting together, to which Dasha are you referring? So I think to myself, I wonder where all the Dashas are. I really wonder. Okay, there are so many things I want to ask you about this book, but incredibly inhumane conditions, inhumane circumstances, and it would have been easy for all these women to just kind of bond together and say it's us against all of them, but they didn't. How did you start figuring out? I mean, there are two primary characters, but how did you start figuring out the interaction of the women who were there?
You know, people often said to me after the book came out, well, why don't, you know, there are only two guards, or there's a third guard who turns out to be a woman called Nancy who calls herself a nurse, but it becomes quite clear that she has absolutely zero nursing qualifications. And Nancy, of course, sides with the men, as some women tend to do. And I was asked often, well, why don't these girls all get together and overpower these captors? First of all, there's a huge electric fence around this property. It's a big area that they're kept in, but it's surrounded. They're shown on the first day that this is a very dangerous electric fence and there's no way they can get out of there. But my main answer to this, when people say, why don't those women unite and overthrow the oppressor, my answer is, why don't we do that? You know, I look out every day, I see around me still examples of egregious sexism and misogyny that are partially enabled by women. You know, there is a lot of internalized misogyny. We don't, because we're human beings, we don't all agree with each other. You know, the idea that everyone in the same circumstance must be united is just, we just don't see the evidence of that. I mean, and the, you know, the women surrounding and enabling Epstein, particularly Ghislaine Maxwell, obviously, but they're, you know, who are these secretaries lining up these things? What are these? They know what's happening. The women mm-hmm. surrounding Trump, they know what's happening. There are women abused all over the place, enabled by other women. And also in my book, I wanted to make it clear that these young women see themselves as individuals. They're not part of a group, you know, and they don't all get along, which again, to me, is completely natural and normal that, mm-hmm. you know, anyone who's ever been in a classroom or on a tour bus or something, just because you're all there together does not mean you're going to be best friends. And also they're under enormous pressure.
So one of the things that occurred to me as reading this, okay, and then we're going to go David first and then Jim. I used to work for John McCain, who was a member of Congress. He was a POW for 6.5 years in Vietnam. And for a big chunk of it, he was in solitary. But then there was a big chunk of it where they were in these group rooms, 30, 40 to a room kind of thing. And when you don't know anything about it, you assume they would all act the same. And they would respond to their captors the same. And they would be, you just know. There were different personalities and different approaches, and it changed over time. And I had the same sort of, it kind of came back to me as I was reading the book. Okay, David, you're first.
Charlotte, you mentioned, and I think it's important because Americans tend to be geographically obtuse. Mm-hmm. The vastness and the bigness, I think, of Australia seems to, I think, play a big part in this book. And I just, can you explain why that would be daunting for somebody, even if they wanted to try to escape being in the middle of a continent? Like, it's not like the size of Texas. It's like, you know what I mean? Like, it's part of, the geography's part of the story, I think.
That's such a great point, David. Thank you. Yes, these young women are all urban girls. You know, they've barely been out of the city. So when they arrive in this place, it's this sort of run down, broken down, old sort of farm buildings and this horrible sort of sheds and things. And in fact, they're kept in what they come to call dog kennels, and they are former shearers quarters, so sheep shearing quarters. And when I was looking at the, you know, trying to imagine this world that I was creating, I looked at a lot of images of you know, historic buildings on farmland out in the middle of Australia. And honestly, some of those buildings that the shearers, the laborers were living in, looked like dog kennels to me. They were very rudimentary, and you know, there was no luxury at all. The middle of Australia, I mean, I've just said the middle of Australia, you know, who knows where it is? It's an imaginary place, but it's very hot. It's very dry. It's sort of scrubby landscape. There's bush around outside, you know, forest outside the fence, but they are in these very harsh physical conditions. And one of the things they have to do is build a road, you know, with their bare hands, basically. And I sort of neglected to say earlier that the original spark for this novel came from a real prison in the west of my mm-hmm. state, which is not as remote as where my book is set, but in a town called Hay. It was called the Hay Institution for Girls. Mm-hmm. It was operating in the 60s and 70s. It was in the town, so it wasn't as remote as this, but it was a brutal prison for young women who had spoken out against sexual abuse and sexual assault. And it was insane that these young women would tell somebody what happened to them and they were put in prison. This is real. that was kind of the inspiration. And there's a documentary on our national broadcaster about this place that was operating when I was coming into my early adolescence. It was still going. Right. And it was a government-run institution. And these places were common. You know, it wasn't that this was a kind of, I mean, I was so shocked and outraged when I heard about it, and I couldn't get it out of my head, which is why I started writing about it. But I've since learned they're everywhere. You know, they were everywhere around Australia. They certainly were, you know, you hear about the Magdalene laundries in Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Ireland.
I'm sure that in America there must have been places to, you know, put annoying, troublesome girls. So And one of the things in this real place that they had, there were all kinds of psychological tortures and punishments. And one of them was that these young women had to build a crazy paving stone path from one building to another. And when they'd finished doing that, they had to smash it up. It's just sick, kind of. Okay. I mean, this is torture, you know.
I swear to God, Jim. Okay, go, I'm going to tell a 10-second story about John McCain. So one of the times when they were at POWs and they were in this group, and they would do all sorts of things just to keep themselves from going crazy, and they decided that they were going to put on a show, and I'm going to make it up, but I think it was South Pacific or something like that. Swear to God. And they assigned parts, and they wrote to the extent they could write scripts down, and they practiced and rehearsed and everything, and it was what was keeping them going. And the night before they were going to put on the show, their captors came in, the Vietnamese came in and broke them up as a group. And John said that was one of the worst things that happened to him in his time there. I'm sorry, Jim Grady, go. James Grady actually knows something about writing, Charlotte, unlike me, certainly on the show.
Well, I'm also, I want to thank you and congratulate you and kind of honor you, Charlotte, because not only did you create a fictional world that is astonishing, all right, and really overwhelms the reader. As you mentioned, you in a way did a great deal of journalism here. The kind of, I was an investigative reporter for 4 years while I was starting my novelist career. And one of the things that I grew up with was a state in called Montana, where they had a specific prison for teenage girls that was considered not even worth talking about, and that existed. And then the other thing that really struck me from my experiences in reality is I covered prostitution in the streets of Washington, D.C. And the system of creating entrapped, drugged women was operating in the streets of Washington, D.C. within a mile and a half of the White House. And they had this social structure where the pimps enforcer was called the bottom lady, and the bottom lady kept her fellow prisoners in, you know, doing what the pimp said, and they all created this closed society. They were often drugged, they were often locked up when they were not on the streets. They would be locked up in co-joined apartments was one technique. And when I was reading your novel, I was getting flashbacks. And it was something that I really wanted to be able to tell you that you got incredibly right based on what is going on in the world today and what I saw yesterday.
Thank you.
I hate to say the New York Times nails anything, but I think that review, it's just so current. We would like to think that this was so long ago and hundreds of years ago. No, we're talking not so recently and probably a certain amount still going on today, right?
Oh, I would agree. I think that I don't know if there's as, you know, multinational and as large of a monster as Jeffrey Epstein was. But there are two or three or four or a dozen probably out there now.
Right. He's one we know about, Jim.
Yeah.
He's one we know about.
Yeah. And I would bet he inspired, you know, he somehow inspired them. They just tried to figure out now, what did he do wrong that got him caught? And let's hope they don't figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Charlotte, we cannot talk about this book. We couldn't talk about Sonya on Devotional without talking about animals. Animals play a very big part in your books. Mice, rabbits, kangaroos. I often, whenever I have the time, I read the books that we're going to talk about in the show, and I listen to them. And without giving anything away, because everyone should go out and buy The Natural Way of Things, the scene with the kangaroo, I am slamming my finger into my phone to fast forward through that in my car. Because like, oh, I mean, I think you love animals. How hard was it to write about what happens to animals in this book?
Yeah, well, animals are really interesting and kind of creatively useful in fiction. I think partly there's an Australian writer called Amanda Laurie, and she once said to me, I always like a novel to have what she called messages from another realm. And I love the way that animals can bring a kind of almost mystical sensibility, or you know, animals know things we don't know, and animals can, they exist on another kind of realm than us. You know, their senses are much more powerful than ours, and so on. But also I'm kind of interested in the way that human beings both sentimentalize and brutalize animals kind of at the same time. But also in the natural way of things, the animals' captivity mirrors the women's captivity. And they're trying to, you know, sometimes the women gravitate to the animals in a kind of mothering way. They have sorrow for the animals, but they also need to eat the animals because at a certain point the food runs out in this place, and the male guards understand that actually they are as captive as the girls at a certain point.
When the baby mice are dying, I was dying. I was in the maternal. I read some interview you did. I can't remember where it was, but the quote from you was, animals in my fiction also seem to have become a way for me to consider other planes of existence. They know things we don't. I think that is so true. I always say all the time, just because animals don't communicate the way we do doesn't mean they're not communicating, and not necessarily at a pretty high level. But
And this book, you know, Yolanda, one of the two main characters, I mean, I think a lot of what I would love readers to take away from this book, although it's a tough read, I'm well aware of that, especially for women. But I would love readers to take away the idea of resistance, you know, and we are increasingly in the world facing, you know, totalitarian oppression. It's growing everywhere. In my country, not so much right now, but it's, you know, it's there. And this misogyny is a form of totalitarian oppression, in my view. And so these two characters, Yolanda and Verla, are the ones who try to find ways to resist. You know, some of the other girls just sort of end up capitulating. One of them in particular just kind of offers herself up to one of the male guards, kind of in return for favors for power, as James, you were saying before, and David. But Verla and Yolanda, in their different ways, come to understand that they are going to refuse as much as they can. And Yolanda becomes very powerful because she starts, the food is running out, and she starts trapping rabbits, and they can eat rabbits. And rabbits in Australia are an invasive species. You know, they're kind of, and I realize, you know.
Oh, yeah, brought in by the Europeans. I know that whole story.
Exactly, as are the mice. You know, the mice that turn into a plague in Stoneyard Devotion are also an introduced invasive species. So obviously there's something in the back of my mind that I wasn't aware of about, you know, these kinds of, you know, the kind of long tail of colonization in this country. But so Yolanda becomes wilder and wilder, and her kind of liberation is sort of stepping out of her human self altogether.
Yeah.
And I won't say what happens in the end, but there is a moment of at which there's kind of a choice for the girls to kind of go with what's happening or just say, I refuse. And Yolanda, Verla, right at the beginning of the book, when she's trying to understand what happened, she's like, sorry, I'm not doing this. I refuse. And they just laugh at her. And then towards the end, there is a moment where she remembers that I can refuse. And
yeah, again, without giving away the ending, and everybody, this book, Natural Way of Things, is great. You expect a certain kind of behavior, and they don't all do the same thing, which is fantastic. Mm. Absolutely fantastic.
And to me, that's just the truth of how we are as human beings, you know, that we often do not act in our own interests. You know, we're seeing it all the time, and this sort of passivity in the face of oppression that is very frightening. But I think it's reality. That's it takes a lot of courage, internal courage, to resist the status quo, and to say, "I'm going to stand up and push back here."
Yeah. We'll get you out with this on the book, and then we're going to subject you to something that's really humane. 60 seconds more. This was a pretty intense examination of human nature and a you know, understanding human nature is not the same across the board. How did this intense examination of how different people respond to these kinds of conditions and women against nature instead of man versus nature, how did it affect how, if it did, how does it affect how you relate to other people or how you behave in your own life?
I think I did really in this book, you know, and it's 10 years ago now, start to examine what it means to step away from the tribe, you know, to step outside the group, which is extremely difficult for human beings. We are, you know, kind of evolved and hardwired to stay in the group because that will protect us. But sometimes it will not protect us. And sometimes what's required to be a full human being is to say, I'm going to risk stepping outside my culture and stepping outside what seems to be protective but is actually doing me damage. Yeah. So, you know, the idea of resistance and courage is something that I started to really examine in this book. And as an artist, that's kind of what you have to do, is step outside your culture, you know, to come up with new ideas and to question things and look at things carefully. Sometimes you have to really step back and step aside. So I think I've tried to learn that what might feel scary is sometimes is scary because there's power there. There's power in something that is scaring you. So as a writer and as an artist, you know, this book was my first book to really kind of break out. And I was frightened when I was writing it. You know, it was very weird and dark and kind of scary and not very nice, you know. Yeah. And I was raised to be a nice, polite, you know, girl. And so seeing what was in my mind and was coming out, when once I finally just went, okay, I'm going to go with this. This book will teach me how to write it. Then I had to sort of see, oh, my God, there's a lot of darkness in there that I was trying to kind of push down and push away. But, you know, and the rage that propelled the writing of this book, you know, I had that when I was writing it, and then I talked about the book for a couple of years afterwards, and then, you know, I've sort of stepped away from that rage. But I tell you, when it came back with this same force and power was reading some of those Epstein emails. And
interesting.
That same boiling rage at this injustice just came pouring out again. And, you know, and I'm actually quite proud of that art can give voice to these feelings that are very hard to understand or express.
Yeah. What's that line, Jim, you probably, but again, I've stolen it from somebody. Sometimes we need fiction to tell the truth. It's something like that.
I love the line, but I can't remember who.
I'm sure I've screwed it up. Okay, wait, before we subject Charlotte to this just horrible exercise of 60 seconds more, but Charlotte, this is how we pay the bills. Has anybody else noticed, Lauren or Jim or Dave, how Charlotte is framed in her
Oh, it's lovely. It's a lovely frame job.
It's kind of angelic.
Yes.
And we're talking about crimes against women and humanity, and she's framed, and it's like a Pope's mitre hat there behind her. It's fantastic.
I'm actually house sitting at my sister-in-law's house. So
it's lovely.
But I like it. I think I might stay here. Yeah.
Hey, Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
Charlotte, we're so happy you've been part of the Chatter family. Thank you for coming back. We wish you the best of luck with this, The Natural Way of Things. Everybody go get it at your independent bookstore. A couple of things, people. We are back in 2 weeks. David, I'm like really in charge of the schedule now. We're back in 2 weeks, and we are going to have David Wright Folliday, also a Chatter alum. Wonderful, wonderful guy. And he is back with the New Internationals, which is very cool. Post-World War II, Paris. Very cool. Wonderful. Jim, I think you're back with us then as well. Good. Lauren, thank you. Jim, thank you. David, thank you. Charlotte, most of all, thank you. Everybody, thank you for listening. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks.